Chapter 10. Giordino spread the contents of the folder on the kitchen table. There were 6 sheets in all. The small aluminum plate Pitt had found in the pocket of the pilot was simmering in a solution Giordino had concocted to bring out the traces of etching in the metal. Pitt and Steiger stood before a crackling fire and sipped coffee. The fireplace was built of native rock. Its heat warmed the entire room.
"You realize the enormous consequences of what you are suggesting?" Steiger asked. "You're conjuring up a serious crime out of thin air without a shred of evidence."
"Stick it in your ear," Pitt said. "You act as though I'm accusing the entire United States Air Force of murder." "I am accusing no one. Granted, the evidence is circumstantial, but I'll stake my life savings that a forensic pathologist will bear me out. The skeleton in the cargo hold did not die 34 years ago with the original crew."
"How can you be sure?"
"Several items don't jibe. To begin with, our unaccounted-for passenger still has flesh on his bones. The others were stripped clean decades ago. This indicates, to me at least, that he died long after the crash. Also, he was tied hand and foot to the cargo tie-down rings. With a little imagination, you could almost envision the earmarks of an old-fashioned gangland slaying."
"You're beginning to wax melodramatic."
"The whole scene reeks of it. One mystery ties illogically to another."
"Okay, let's take what we know to be true," said Steiger. "The aircraft with serial number 75403 exists not where it is supposed to, but nonetheless it exists. And I think we can safely assume the original crew sits down there in the wreck," Steiger continued. "As to the extra body, perhaps the report neglected to mention his status. He might have been a last-minute assignment, a backup engineer or even a mechanic who strapped himself to the cargo rings just before the crash." "Then how do you justify a difference in uniform? He was wearing khakis, not Air Force blues."
"I can't answer that any more than you can say for certain that he was murdered long after the crash."
"There lies the catch," Pitt said evenly. "I've got a solid idea who our uninvited guest is. And if I'm right, his demise by person or persons unknown becomes a fundamental certainty."
Steiger's eyebrows raised.
"I'm listening," he murmured.
"Who do you have in mind?"
"The man who built this cabin. His name was Charlie Smith, Congresswoman Lauren Smith's father."
Steiger sat there silently for a few moments, digesting the enormity of Pitt's statement. Finally, he said,
"What proof can you offer?"
"Quite literally, bits and pieces. I have it on good authority that Charlie Smith's obituary says that he was blown to smithereens in an explosion of his own making. All that was ever found were a boot and one thumb. A nice touch, don't you think? Very neat and precise. I must keep it in mind the next time I want to do somebody in. Set off a blast, then, as soon as the dust settles, throw a recognizable piece of footwear and a slice of the victim's most identifiable anatomy at the edge of the smoking crater. Friends later identify the boot, and the sheriff's department can't miss with a positive ID once they pull a print from the thumb. In the meantime, I've buried the rest of the body where hopefully it will never be found. My victim's death goes down as an accident, and I go merrily on my way."
"You're telling me the skeleton in the aircraft was missing a boot and a thumb?"
Pitt merely nodded an affirmative. At 9:30, Giordino was ready. He started by lecturing Pitt and Steiger as he would a class of high school chemistry students. "As you can see, after more than 3 decades of submersion, the vinyl cover, because it's organic, is virtually as good as new. But the paper inside has nearly returned to pulp. Originally, the contents were mimeographed, a common process prior to the miracle of Xerox. The ink, I'm sorry to say, has all but disappeared, and no laboratory on Earth can bring it back, even under supermagnification. 3 of the sheets are hopeless cases. Nothing vaguely legible remains. The 4th looks like it might have contained weather information. A few words here and there refer to winds, altitudes, and atmospheric temperatures. The only sentence I can partially decipher says, 'Skies clearing beyond western slopes.'"
"Western slopes indicating the Colorado Rockies," said Pitt.
Steiger's hands gripped the edge of the table.
"Christ, do you have any idea what that means?"
"It means 03's flight didn't originate from California, as stated in the report," said Pitt.
Her departure point must have been east of here if the crew was concerned about weather conditions over the Continental Divide. So much for data sheet number 4, said Giordino. Now then, compared to the rest, sheet 5 is a veritable treasure trove of information. Here we can faintly make out several word combinations, including the names of 2 crew members. Many of the letters are missing, but with a bit of elementary deduction we can figure the meanings. Look here, for instance. Giordino pointed to the sheet of paper, and the other 2 leaned in closer. A space RC space FT space OMM space ND space R colon space MA space AY space ON space V space L space NDE. Now we fill in the blanks, Giordino continued, and we come up with aircraft commander, Major Raymond Vilander. And here's the combination, said Pitt, pointing. This spells out the name and rank of the flight engineer. Joseph Burns, Giordino acknowledged. In the lines that follow, the missing characters are too numerous to guess their intent. Then this. Giordino pointed farther down on the paper. ODE space N space ME colon space IX space N space 03. Classified call sign, injected Pitt. Every aircraft on a security flight is given one. Usually a noun, followed by the last 2 digits of the aircraft's number. Steiger fixed Pitt with a look of genuine respect. How would you know that? Picked it up somewhere, Pitt said, shrugging it off. Giordino traced over the blank areas. So now we have code name something 03. What nouns have IX in the middle of them? Steiger mused. Chances are the missing letter after X is E or O. How about Nixon, Giordino suggested. I seriously doubt that a mere transport plane would be named after a vice president, Pitt said. Vixen 03 seems closer to the mark. Vixen 03, Steiger repeated softly. That's as good a shot as any. Moving right along, said Giordino. Our final decipherable scrap on the 5th sheet is E blank A, Rongolo 060 blank. Estimated time of arrival, 6 in the morning at Rongolo, Steiger translated, his expression still incredulous. Where in hell is that? Vixen 03 was scheduled to land in Hawaii. I only call them the way I sees them, said Giordino. What about the 6th sheet? Pitt asked. Pretty slim pickings, all gibberish except for a date and a security classification near the bottom. See for yourself. RDERS blank D, blank TE, blank ANU, blank RY, blank 2, comma, blank 954, AUT, blank OR, blank Z, blank D, blank Y, colon, blank R, blank LT, blank R, blank B, blank S, TO, blank SE, blank R, blank T, blank COD, blank 1A. Steiger hovered over the indefinite wording. First line reads, orders dated January, sometime between the 20th and 29th, 1954. Pitt said, the second line looks like authorized by, but the officer's name is lost. The rank of general fits, though. Then comes top secret code 1A, said Giordino. You can't get a classified rating any higher than that. I think it's safe to assume, said Pitt, that someone in the upper echelons of either the Pentagon or the White House, or both, released a misleading accident report on Vixen 03 as a cover-up. In my years with the Air Force, I've never heard of such an act. Why instigate a flagrant lie over an ordinary aircraft on a routine flight? Face facts, Colonel. Vixen 03 was no ordinary aircraft. The report states the flight originated at Travis Air Force Base near San Francisco and was scheduled to land at Hickam Field in Hawaii. We now know the crew was heading for a destination named Rongolo. Giordino scratched his head. I can't recall ever hearing of a place called Rongolo. Nor I, said Pitt. But we can settle that mystery as soon as we lay our hands on a world atlas. So, what have we got? Asked Steiger. Not much, admitted Pitt. Only that during the latter part of January 1954, a C-97 took off from a point either in the eastern or midwestern section of the United States on a top-secret flight. But something went wrong over Colorado. a mechanical malfunction that forced the crew to ditch the plane in the worst terrain imaginable. They got lucky, or so they thought. Miraculously avoiding smashing into a mountainside, Vilander found an open clearing and lined up the Stratocruiser for an emergency landing. But what they couldn't see, remember it was January and the ground was undoubtedly covered with snow, was in grim reality a lake frozen over with ice. "So, when the aircraft's momentum slowed and its weight settled," said Steiger vacantly, "the ice parted and she fell through." "Exactly. The tidal surge of water into the broken ship and the staggering shock of the cold overwhelmed the crew before they had a chance to react, and they drowned in their seats. No one witnessed the crash. The water refroze over the grave, and all traces of the tragedy were neatly erased. The ensuing search discovered nothing, and Vixen 03 was later concealed behind a phony accident report and conveniently forgotten." "You've written an interesting plot," said Giordino, "and it plays well. But where does Charlie Smith come into the story?" "He must have hooked the oxygen tank while fishing. Possessing an inquisitive mind, he probably dragged the area and wrenched the already broken nose gear loose from the wreckage. The expression on his face must have been priceless when the gear popped to the surface," Giordino said, smiling. "Even if I accept Smith's murder," said Steiger, "I fail to see a motive." Pitt raised his eyes and looked at Steiger. "There is always a motive for taking a man's life." "The cargo," Giordino blurted, incredulous at his own realization. "It was a highly classified flight. It stands to reason that whatever Vixen 03 was transporting was worth a great deal to somebody, worth enough to kill for." Steiger shook his head. "If the cargo is so valuable, why wasn't it salvaged by Smith or his supposed killer? According to Pitt here, it's still down there." "And sealed tight," Pitt added. "As near as I could tell, the canisters have never been opened." Giordino cleared his throat. "Next question." "Shoot." "What's inside the canisters?" "You had to ask," said Pitt. "Well, one conjecture bears consideration. Take an aircraft carrying cylindrical canisters on a secret mission somewhere in the Pacific Ocean in January of 1954. "Of course," interrupted Giordino. "Nuclear bomb tests were being held at Bikini at that time." Steiger rose to his feet and stood motionlessly. "Are you implying that Vixen 03 was transporting nuclear warheads?" "I'm not implying anything," Pitt said casually. "I am merely offering a possibility, and an intriguing one at that. Why else would the Air Force put the lid on a missing plane and throw up a smokescreen of misleading information to cloud the disappearance? Why else would a flight crew risk almost certain death to ride down a crippled aircraft in the mountains instead of taking to their parachutes and allowing it to crash, perhaps in or near a populated area?" "There's one vital point that sinks your theory. The government would have never given up searching for a lost cargo of nuclear warheads. I admit you have me there. It does seem odd that enough destruction to obliterate half the country would be left to litter the environment." Suddenly, Steiger wrinkled his nose. "What is that god-awful stench?" Giordino hurriedly rose and moved over to the stove. "I think the metal tag is done. What are you boiling it in?" "A combination of vinegar and baking soda. They're all I could find that would do the trick."
"Are you sure it will bring out the etching?"
"Couldn't say. I'm not a chemist. Won't hurt it, though." Steiger threw up his hands in exasperation and turned to Pitt. "I knew I should have saved this stuff for professional lab technicians." Giordino calmly ignored Steiger's remark and delicately lifted the plate out of the boiling water with two forks and patted it dry with a dish towel. Then he held it up to the light, turning it at different angles.
"What do you see?" Pitt asked.
Giordino set the small aluminum plate down on the table in front of them. He inhaled deeply, his features taking on a grave expression. "A symbol," he said tensely. "The symbol for radioactivity.